an interdenominational. Campus Crusade for Christ International, an interdenominational Christian movement, was founded by Dr. Bill Bright. It serves as an evangelistic arm of the church by helping to present Jesus Christ to students, athletes, faculty, military, and lay people of the world. Campus Crusade places a strong emphasis on the great historic doctrines of the Christian faith, including the deity of Christ, His atoning death for our sins, and the inspiration and authority of the Scriptures. Our goal is to help win the world by introducing people to Christ and training them to win others. Key messages are now available on tape to help win your world for Christ.
Our first speaker of the evening is the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner, a man of great influence in our nation, and especially in one of the most strategic cities of our nation, where there is so much unrest, especially in the Berkeley area. Charles Gould has been with the Hearst organization for more than 30 years, has been in the newspaper business for more than 35 years, was appointed the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner.
You got the name right and you got the paper right. That's the commercial. And after that act that we had, the performance we've had thus far, I almost feel that it's out of order for me to speak.
Well, I'm sure that's not true.
The message that was presented tonight should be one that stays with all of us. It's one that has great meaning and great depth. And I feel... I feel a little awkward following such a beautiful act. And at the very outset, I'd like to make it patently clear that I do not presume to stand before you as an expert in any sense of the word. I stand before you as a newspaper man and as a newspaper reader who has been watching world developments with care and concern for many years. I also speak to you as a Navy man who has been privileged to serve in many areas of the world in three wars. It is from the knowledge I've gained through these experiences that I address you tonight. I will touch on many controversial subjects. I will touch on some sensitive issues that torment and trouble our people. I do not expect you to agree with all I say. I recognize and respect your right to contrary views, and I stoutly defend you in that right. I solicit your consideration in the same degree. Now, I will not offer any sweeping recommendations for curing the ills and evils that trouble our world. I will not offer any instant panaceas for the current controversies that concern our communities. Hopefully, though, I will present some facts that will provide a new perspective on our world, and some new yardsticks for measuring the challenges that confront us at home and abroad. First and foremost, let us recognize that this is an age of explosive growth and change. This is an age in all history when tensions and pressures are greatest, when challenges are greatest, and fortunately, when opportunities are greatest. This is the most exciting, most accelerating, most stimulating, most frustrating and most frightening hour in the history of mankind. For this is an age of instant evolution. This is an age of instant revolution, an age of instant communications. It is also an age of instant death. This is an age when man moves towards solving the mysteries of the highest heavens and of the deepest oceans. Man has broken the shackles that bound him to earth, and for the first time in all history, he pokes and probes at the stars. He touches the face of the universe. Man has harnessed the might and magic of the atom and now holds destiny in the hollow of his hands. He has unlocked doors that open the way to tremendous power, indescribable power. Power for good or power for evil. He has, in truth, discovered the secret of instant death. The ability to devastate and desolate entire sections of the globe. In one lifetime, man has made greater strides in science and physics and medicine and engineering than did all his forebears in 1,000 generations of struggle up the ladder of civilization. In this same lifetime, however, man has proved in 2 great wars and 12 smaller ones that he is socially nearer the jungle than he is to the peaceful utopia that had been his dream through all eternity. Man has made remarkable strides in conquering outer space, but how futile have been his efforts in conquering inner space, the space in the hearts and minds of men. Take a look at your own country. Study the appalling moral erosions that are all too evident throughout the width and breadth of our fair land. We find educators speaking out in favor of free love. Religious groups launch campaigns to bring acceptance to homosexuality. Priests, rabbis, preachers, and educators take the witness stand to defend poems that describe in sewer language subjects born in a brothel. Newspapers, magazines, and TV present pictures and reports that violate the bounds of good taste. Birth control council is urged for high school girls. Look around you. These things are happening in your America. In the years since the end of World War II, we have seen our national standards of morality lowered again and again. We have seen a steady erosion of past principles of decency and good taste. And we have harvested a whirlwind. As our standards have lowered, our crime levels and social problems have increased. Today, we have a higher percentage of our youth in jail, in reformatories, on probation, and in trouble than ever before. Study the statistics on illegitimate births, on broken marriages, on juvenile crimes, on school dropouts, on sex deviation, on dope addiction, on crimes of passion, on high school marriages. The figures are higher than ever and going higher. Each year, for the past 10 years, more than 100,000 teenage girls in the United States have given birth to illegitimate children. Last year, the figure soared beyond 130,000. A study recently prepared by the federal government predicts that one boy in every 6 across the width and breadth of this nation will be arrested before 18 years of age for some offense more serious than a traffic violation. These are not statistics. These are children, yours and mine. Parents, police authorities, educators, and thoughtful citizens in all walks of life are deeply disturbed, and they should be. For they are responsible. We of the older generation are responsible. Our youngsters are no better and no worse than we were at the same age. Generally, they are wiser. But they have more temptations than we had. They have more cars. They have more money. They have more opportunities for getting into trouble. We open doors for them that were denied to us. We encourage permissiveness. We indulge them. We granted maximum freedoms, and we ask for a minimum in respect and in responsibility. And, of course, our courts have not helped. They have handed down decisions that make a mockery out of justice. Rules and regulations that prevailed for generations as sane and sensible guidelines for personal conduct were reduced or removed or ignored. Police officers are required to observe Marcus of Queensbury rules in dealing with punks, perverts, and thugs. We mollycoddle young criminals and release unreformed hoodlums to prey on society. And now, while I am heartily in favor of sound and sensible programs for rehabilitating criminals, I am unalterably opposed to legal loopholes which permit hardened, vicious criminals with long records of serious infractions to escape just and proper punishment. Unfortunately, the courts, in a desire to protect the rights of the individual, have too often ignored the rights of the many. And we, too, have rights. As our laws and regulations have been eased and relaxed, we have found our crime rate soaring to new highs. Every 7 seconds, a major crime is committed in these United States. Every 56 minutes of every hour of every day, some innocent man, woman, or child is murdered in our land. Every 31 minutes of every hour of every day, some woman is raped. Every 3 minutes, somewhere in the United States, another person becomes the victim of vicious assault with a knife, a gun, a club, or some other lethal weapon. Last year, more than 4,400,000 serious crimes were reported in the United States, and this was an increase of 17% over the previous year, and the trend continues. A comprehensive nationwide study of criminals paroled in 1963 showed more than 60% were rearrested within 4 years. 91% of those acquitted or dismissed in 1963 were rearrested within 4 years. In short, we are indulging in the costly and dangerous luxury of a revolving door approach to criminal justice. And despite these shocking truths, we still find men and women in high places who urge even greater leniency in the handling of criminals. We find men of God and teachers and public officials condoning the acts of some lawbreakers and urging others to break the laws they find personally repugnant. They argue that they act on higher judgment. They argue that moral laws supersede man-made laws. But whose morals? Whose standards? These dewy-eyed do-gooders travel a path that could lead to the destruction of our carefully structured and time-tested fortress of rules and laws and regulations. For if we allow each man to make his own laws as he is morally or spiritually motivated, we have no laws, except the laws of the jungle. Because of these rampant digressions from reason and responsibility, because of these appalling moral erosions, because of these skyrocketing crime rates, I find I have become a conscientious objector. As a troubled citizen, I feel I must in good conscience raise my voice against those who preach and practice hate and discord and disunity. I object to broadcast commentators and newspaper writers who feed the flames of fear by allowing rumors, guesses, speculation, and conjecture to masquerade as fact. I object to men of God who sow the seeds of conflict and encourage disrespect for temporal law and authority. I object to judges who presume to make laws rather than to interpret them. I object to groups and individuals who profess to champion peace but resort to terror, violence, and blackmail. I object to those who campaign and petition and parade for individual rights but have no tolerance for the rights of those who oppose them. I object to those who desecrate our flag, denounce our Constitution, and extol the godless ideologies of other lands. I object to whites who preach hatred of blacks, and I object to blacks who preach hatred of whites. I object to inequities and injustices suffered by any of our people, just as I object to special privileges and special treatment for any of our people. I object to white power and black power and poor power and rich power. The only social powers I endorse are fair power and truth power and the will power of all of our people. In short, I object to those groups and individuals within our country who champion any system at variance with the basic concept of equal rights and equal opportunities and equal responsibilities that must be the hallmarks of our way of life. I object, therefore, to the Rap Browns, the Eldridge Cleavers, and the Bobby Seals who incite their followers to burn, kill, and destroy. I object even more to Dr. Herbert Marcuse, Dr. Edgar Freidenberg, and a host of other false prophets who have contaminated our colleges and universities with a poisonous virus of anarchy and revolution. Now, while I'm in this protest mood, let me raise my voice against the distorted image of our nation and of our generation that has been painted by Senator Moore, Senator Fulbright, and others who have called ours a sick and divided nation. These charges are unfair, unjust, and untrue. They apply to only a small segment of our population. Even these ugly statistics that I've just cited refer to only a tiny percentage of all of our citizens. The vast majority of our people, regardless of race, creed, color, or economic status, are respectable, reasonable, responsible citizens. And I think it's time we started accenting the positive. This year, for example, more than 196 million of our people will not be arrested. More than 89 million married persons will not file for divorce. More than 115 million individuals will maintain a formal affiliation with some religious group. More than 75 million citizens and corporations will pay more than $160 billion in income taxes. More than 49 million students will not riot or petition or to destroy our system. More than 9 million of our young men will not burn their draft cards. More than 4 million teachers, preachers, and professors will not strike or participate in riotous demonstrations. Yes, I have no apologies to make for my country or for my generation. Never before in history or in any other land has a people accomplished so much, given so much, and asked so little. 4 times in 1 lifetime we've involved ourselves in foreign wars. We've poured the flower of our manhood and the fortunes of our citizens into these battles against aggression, injustice, and tyranny. We have never coveted a single acre of land or sought to add a dollar to our national wealth. Quite the contrary. We have used our material strength and financial fortunes to bind the wounds of the vanquished, and we have given aid and sustenance to the impoverished in 100 nations around the globe, friend and foe alike. We have battled, too, for progress and improvement on the home front. In 1 generation, we have conquered or controlled diphtheria, smallpox, typhoid, polio, measles, tuberculosis, and pneumonia. No longer do these ancient scourges sweep across our land, leaving death and tortured limbs and minds and hearts in their wake. We have built more schools and colleges and hospitals and libraries than all generations since the beginning of time. We have trained and graduated more scientists, doctors, surgeons, dentists, lawyers, teachers, engineers, and physicists than did our forebears for 1,000 years before. We have raised our standards of living and lowered our hours of work. Luxuries that were beyond the dreams of princes and potentates a generation ago are now available to all of our people. We have taxed ourselves unmercifully to bring hope and health to our sick, our indigent, our young, and our aged. Why, each year our personal gifts to private charities exceed $14 billion. That's more than 15 times the cost of running the entire federal government the year I was born. We've done more to bring dignity and equality and opportunity to all minority groups than any other generation has ever done in any nation since the dawn of history. Now, let me make it clear that I do not minimize the need for greater efforts in these areas. We have an urgent moral responsibility to move decisively in correcting injustices that have too long prevailed. At the same time, we must not minimize the progress that has been made. And a recent official report shows that since 1960, the number of Negro families earning more than $7,000 a year has increased more than 100%. In just 4 years, the number of Negroes hired for professional jobs has climbed 35%. Total Negro employment has jumped more than 20%. Today, the average Negro in our nation is more likely to go to college than the average citizen, white or black, in England, Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Italy, or Spain. We have more than 300 Negro millionaires in our nation. We have more Negroes sitting as judges, more in Congress, more in state legislatures, more in our city halls, and more in positions of power than all the communist nations of the world combined. Yes, don't let anyone tell you or sell you the idea that ours is a sick society. It's far from perfect, but it is also far and away the most enlightened, most unselfish, most compassionate in the history of the world. Let those apostles of despair who preach hate and disorder and discord take a look in their own mirrors. Let them ask themselves what they have done and what they are doing for the betterment of their loved ones, their nation, and the world. I know what our generation has done. I'll stand on our record. We may not have scored as high as we hoped, but we scored higher than ever before, and the end is not yet. There is still work to be done. There are still challenges to be met. There are still hopes to be realized. There are still goals to be attained. They'll not be attained by the preachers and teachers of despair. They'll not be attained by sniffing flowers or staging love-ins or hate-ins. They'll be attained by the unsung heroes of every generation, the workers who can dream, and the doers who can hope. They'll be attained by the men and women who cherish our nation's glorious past, who hold their heads and their hearts high, the men and women who have faith in our way of life, men and women who believe in a better and brighter tomorrow and are willing to work toward that end. Now, with your permission, I'd like to turn briefly to the world stage. For the role of the United States in world affairs touches the hearts and homes and hopes and pocketbooks of every citizen in our 50 states. I'd like to turn the clock back almost 25 years. That huge mushroom cloud that hung over Hiroshima 23 and a half years ago marked the end of World War II, It also signaled the beginning of a new war. There has not been a single hour during these long and tortured years when bitter, brutal fighting was not going on in some quarter of the globe. There was the onslaught in Egypt, there were scrimmages in Iraq, there was Korea and the Suez Canal, Cuba, Hungary, the Dominican Republic, and Lebanon. There was Tibet, Laos, the Congo, Pakistan, Kashmir, India, Rhodesia. There was and is the war in Vietnam. During these treacherous years since the end of World War II, the United States has waged the most costly battle for peace the world has ever known. In the past 20 years, your government has poured forth more than $125 billion of your dollars in foreign aid and military assistance. Take a map of the world and close your eyes and put a pin in any inhabited area and you'll touch some people who have benefited as a result of the generous heart and open pocketbooks of you, the taxpayers of the United States. In these same years, the godless leaders of communism were also engaged in wars. They battled, but not for peace. They didn't use dollars for their offenses. They used intrigue. They used deceit. They broke contracts. They broke agreements. They broke the will of the people. And when needs to be, they used terror, violence, revolution, and war. And how successful were the communists? Again, I ask you to visualize a map of the world. Since World War II, the iron and bamboo curtains were stretched to envelop additional countries, and we have witnessed the enslavement of a billion people as Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Albania, China, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, North Korea, North Vietnam, Cuba, Tibet disappeared from the family of free nations. In the meantime, the United States and other nations of the Western Bloc championed the emancipation of all nations of the world, and they gave more than lip service to these aims. Since the end of World War II, the Western Bloc has given freedom and independence to the Philippines, the Cameroon, Ceylon, India, Pakistan, Israel, Malaya, Nigeria, Somalia, Sudan, Togoland, Sierra Leone, and two dozen other nations with strange-sounding names. The free world has given freedom and independence to this long list of former colonies and protectorates. Freedom to more than 30 nations and more than a billion men, women, and children. Who then are the aggressors? Those who preach and practice freedom, or those who enslave the hearts and minds of men? For despite the battle for peace, the forces of tyranny have not withdrawn one inch in their struggle for world domination. Typical of the universal terroristic tactics of the communists is the frightening and frustrating challenge that confronts the United States and a tortured and tormented nation halfway around the globe. Hopefully, President Nixon's conference with President Thieu this weekend and the Paris peace talks will eventually bring an honorable solution to the tragic Vietnamese conflict. Do not be deluded, though, into believing a ceasefire will bring true peace to that troubled land. Unfortunately, the best we can hope is a kind of armed truce that has kept our troops on the alert in Korea for more than a decade and a half. We must also anticipate other aggressive excursions by the communists in the months that lie ahead. Laos is a likely target, and an open conflict may develop before the fighting in Vietnam ends. There will probably be fresh outbreaks of violence in the Formosan Straits, and the tinderbox of Israel in the Middle East is again heating up. Korea will continue to be explosive. The tragedy of Czechoslovakia may be repeated in Romania and Yugoslavia. India, Pakistan, Africa, Central America, and South America are continuing trouble spots. And we can be sure that the newly expanded Russian Navy will be on the prowl in all the oceans of the world. In short, the communists can be expected to poke and probe at the nerve centers of the world. They will practice their own dangerous brand of brinkmanship. We failed to read and heed Hitler's Mein Kampf, and we paid a terrible price for neglecting to study and analyze this blueprint for destiny through destruction. We cannot afford to make the same mistake again. The communists have their manifesto for world domination. It has been endorsed by Lenin. It was supported by Stalin. It has been championed by Beria, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Kosygin, and Mao. It is a concept of world domination through destruction and deception. It has been followed faithfully by the communist hierarchy these many years. They are still practicing it. They will continue to practice it in the future. They will plead for disarmament. They will plead for nuclear controls, but always on their terms. They will preach peace but prepare for war. It is imperative, therefore, that we remain strong and vigilant as we seek the road to a true and just and lasting peace. Now, in this regard, it should be recognized that in this tinderbox period of the hydrogen bomb, the greatest deterrent to all-out war is the enemy's knowledge that we have the capacity to retaliate against the first attack. The communists do know of the devastating strength and firepower that the United States can direct against Russia or China in the event of surprise attack. I refer, of course, to the spectacular capabilities of our missile forces, our Strategic Air Command, and in particular, our Polaris and Poseidon fleet. The planes aloft of the Strategic Air Command and the units of the fleet that are at sea cannot be wiped out on a first strike surprise by the enemy. Thus, our retaliatory capabilities are inherent in our present military posture. Now, in my opinion, with a Navy man's natural pride and perhaps a little prejudice, forgive me, Colonel, I believe that the nuclear-powered Polaris and Poseidon submarines are the primary weapon, or one of the primary weapons in our great arsenal, and one of the major deterrents to sneak attack by the enemy. For example, as I speak to you, dozens of these silent sentinels of strength are on patrol. Dozens of powerhouses for freedom on station in the Atlantic, in the Pacific, and more are being completed. The awesome power of the existing fleet staggers the human imagination. Get this picture, if you will. At this very moment, somewhere in the dark depths of the Atlantic and the Pacific, these ships are guarding your home and guarding mine. They cruise on unknown courses at unknown depths, at unknown speeds, and unknown destinations. No one in the Pentagon knows exactly where they are. No one in the Kremlin can possibly know where they are. And note well these points. Each of these ships carries 16 guided missiles equipped with nuclear warheads. Each of these ships has the firepower, the destructive power of all the planes and tanks and ships and mines and guns of all the nations engaged in World War II. Think of it. Each of these submarines can release in less than 30 minutes more devastating firepower than all of the armies and navies of World War II were able to release in more than 4 years of battle. Each of the missiles on each of these submarines can be given the address of some strategic target deep in the heart of the communist homeland. And no present power on earth can keep them from delivering a new and more horrible version of the scorched earth policy practiced by the Reds during World War II. Yes, the communists know the power of these weapons. They know that any attack on the United States or any of our allies might well be the signal for lethal and accurate retaliation that can destroy their cities and factories and farms. And I join with you in a prayer to God. The awesome weapons will never be used in anger. And so long as we maintain this absolute power to retaliate, it is my firm conviction that the communists will never launch a major attack. These ships of ours, this underwater navy of ours, and the planes of the Air Force, together with the mighty missiles that stand at the ready, are the free world's major source of material and military strength today. But we need more than military strength. We need moral strength. We need willpower. We need conviction and determination and dedication. And these are individual strengths that cannot be generated by military leaders nor by political leaders. This kind of strength and power must come from the brains and the hearts of the people. It must come from you and come from me. For this is both the test and the power of our system. Our national strength comes not from our political leaders. It comes from the 190 million citizens who have never failed our constitutional principles in an hour of crisis. And to preserve this strength at the individual level, we must strive to improve our communications at the individual level. We must each reaffirm our faith in our way of life. We must take a new and honest and objective look at the rich and glorious heritage that is ours, the one that was enunciated so beautifully a few minutes ago. Why, long before that imposing glass edifice to man's hopes and dreams was erected at 42nd Street and the East River in New York City, we were in truth a united nation. We were a nation born of oppressed peoples. We were born in revolt against tyranny and slavery. We were a nation enriched by the strength and culture of 100 nations. In our national bloodstreams are strains of every land. We are Greek and Pole and Russian. We are German, Dane, and Dutch. We are French and Turk and Czech. We are Indian, Chinese, Japanese, and Serb. We are Mongol, Italian, English, Irish, and Finn. We are black and white and red and yellow. We are Catholic, Protestant, and Jew. We are Muslim and Buddhist and Shinto. We worship at all shrines and have heartstrings that reach across all oceans. We have a culture enriched by centuries of struggle as our fathers and their fathers before them cast off their yokes and fought for freedom and opportunity. We have the heritage of Bunker Hill, of Lexington and Concord. Our fathers fought and died for principles of pride and decency and honor at Gettysburg, Chancellorsville, and Bull Run. Yes, and at Chateau-Thierry, the Marne, Okinawa, Normandy, the chosen reservoir, and now in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. We came from 100 lands and we built a new nation. Our sons have returned to those lands and fought and died in defense of principles we hold dear. Unfortunately, however, in the recent past, pride in country has fallen on hard times. We have tended to downgrade and discount our glorious past. We have minimized the role we have played in raising the hearts and hopes of all enslaved peoples. We have clouded the accomplishments of our nation's heroes as a result of the actions and remarks of a few. Patriotism, honest, honorable patriotism, has become suspect. Patriotism has become a nasty word. Well, not in my book. For myself, I blush not when I declare for the record that I have great pride in my nation. I have great pride in our history. I have great pride in our heroes. I have great pride in our flag. Just as I hesitate not a moment to proclaim my love for my family and my love for my God, I hesitate not a moment to profess my love for my country. I have no desire to lock these feelings in my heart. And if this pride and this posture causes me to be labeled a flag-waving provincial, as it has, I consider the charge as the highest personal compliment. Now, let there be no misunderstanding of what I say. I do not endorse any organization. I do not endorse any special group or any special interest. I do endorse the plain, old-fashioned 4th of July kind of spine-tingling personal patriotism that was such a rich part of our national culture for 165 years. Now, there are those who say we have no ideology to match the promise and hope of the communists. I say let them read again the Declaration of Independence. Let them carefully and thoughtfully study the story of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. These are the instruments of our national strength, of our individual strength. These are the flags that fanned the spark of hope in the hearts of oppressed peoples for a century and a half. Let us again communicate these truths to our people and to our neighbors. If we do this, we'll have less of a problem making our citizens understand our tax programs and our space programs and our military programs. We'll have less of a task in bringing true understanding to our people if we spell out in moral and spiritual terms what they're fighting for and what they're paying for and what their sons may be dying for. And it must be our charge to our representatives who sit down at the conference table to seek the road to a just and lasting peace that they speak firmly and with conviction in these aims, these ideas, these ideals. They must have confidence in our inner strength. They must be fortified by the faith and power and courage of our people. They must do what is right, whether it pleases the uncommitted nations or not. They must speak softly, but they must speak from the strength that comes from truth. They must avoid weasel words and insist that honor and justice and truth be served. If we do this, we may not win any international popularity contests, but our national pride and our national prestige can reach new heights, and we can sleep at night in the comfortable knowledge that our children and our children's children will live in peace and freedom under God. I thank you.
Thank you for listening to this message. We have hundreds of similar messages available for use in any listening situation. Have you considered how much of your time could be used twice? That's right, twice. Housewives, you can listen to systematic Bible study tapes and receive inspiration while you are sewing, washing dishes, cooking, or just resting. You businessmen can have a tape recorder in your car and utilize for Bible study the time you spend commuting between your homes and your offices. You can also take tapes of inspirational speakers with you on business trips to challenge your soul and to fill your spiritual needs as you listen to them in your hotel. These messages are not intended to replace the Holy Scriptures, but to supplement them and to accelerate your understanding of the various basic elements of the Christian walk. We have new electronic equipment available through Campus Crusade for Christ, which will help you to enjoy these recordings at very moderate cost. Write to the Audio-Visual Department, Campus Crusade for Christ, Arrowhead Springs, San Bernardino, California, 92404, for a catalog and a booklet on how you can get the most out of your hours every day and how you can use the medium of electronics for Bible study and inspiration.